Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the ETHub weekly newsletter, which covers news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we cover the news from March 25th to March 31st. Hey, Anthony, want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So a couple of one ETHub related announcement this week. So you put out a tweet earlier in the week announcing a new kind of initiative around a new community call and forum. And this kind of came about because of all the prog power chat we've been seeing lately and people not knowing how to measure community sentiment of who wants what. And then there's just all this discussion happening and no action. And then, you know, we had all the discussion from the core devs as well, saying that it's too noisy for them. They don't know, you know, who to side with or who to listen to. The core devs should be focused obviously on the technical things and they shouldn't have to get into the weeds of trying to measure community sentiment and things like that. That should be able to be fed up to them. Now, this is obviously a problem that's, you know, plaguing every kind of decentralized blockchain where it's very hard to gauge sentiment. Like, of course, Bitcoin being the obvious example of that. They split, you know, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin split because of the inability to reach consensus on a kind of a block size increase. And, you know, we're seeing a bit of a mirroring of that with Ethereum. I don't think there's any split on the table, but, you know, ProgPow is becoming a lot more contentious than it needs to be. So, you know, we had this idea of a community call where we could have a bunch of people that have been kind of heavily involved within the Ethereum community for quite a while, you know, provide value, whether that be through, you know, blog posts, participating on forums, on Reddit, on Twitter, anything like that, basically any level of involvement, but kind of heavily involved around basically, you know, for a while, maybe, you know, 1 to 2 years or something like that, and getting them onto a call and discussing all these kind of important issues and trying to formalize something to pass up to the core devs, because at the moment it's really rough and, you know, it's very hard to gauge the sentiment. We're currently in the very early stages of kind of speccing this out and seeing how we want to go about it. We've got like the kind of proof of concept forum up on community.ethub.io. The forum's going to be open to everyone. It's just going to require a Twitter login. We will be moderating it to get rid of the trolls and things like that and spam, but we're not going to be kind of locking anyone out. So even if Bitcoiners want to come on there and start questioning things, they're free to do so as long as they're doing it in good faith and they're not trying to, you know, spread misinformation and things like that. And the community call will be, you know, a select group of people. We don't know how we're going to select the people yet. We might put it to a vote or, you know, it's still very early days. So we don't actually know how we're going to do it, but we do want the call to be a limited number of people, because if you start letting anyone join the call, it gets too noisy and it's very hard to communicate or kind of coordinate a call like that. But you kind of thought about this first, Eric. So did you want to walk through a bit of your thinking around this as well?
Yeah, I mean, you gave a really good recap of it and where we're headed. I mean, it just seemed obvious. I mean, for the first few years in Ethereum, everything was pretty technical on the decision side. And, you know, now it seems like there's some other kind of stakeholders, I guess we'll put it, that want to say. And also, I'll note that, like, I've heard from a lot of the core devs, like, they don't want to be the only ones responsible for some of this decision making. So, you know, I guess we don't really know what it's going to turn into. I hope that it just turns into kind of like another signal that people can use if something's controversial. I don't think it necessarily needs to be used for every decision that's made, right? Like, to me, there's very obvious things such as, say, ProgPow or issuance reductions, things like that, that we probably need some signals outside of just the core devs call. So, you know, we'll experiment on our own. I'm sure some others might do some stuff. But yeah, I guess people want to keep up to date on what we're thinking about, just obviously per usual our Twitters. But yeah, as you mentioned, community.ethub.io is where the forum's going to live. And it'll be kind of interesting to how we select who joins the call. But like, obviously we need to filter it down a little bit, right? Our goal there is for people. Pretty much what I'm thinking is somehow the best representation for the discussions that happen on the forum, make it into the call just to make it concise. And it's like probably just once a month is all that's necessary. And if the core devs are like, hey, that clearly there's some contention over this issue, we should go look at other parts of the community and see what they think. That's where I think this could become valuable.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, we're still early days. So if you've got feedback for us, definitely hit us up on Twitter. We're going to be formalizing a lot of our thinking around this, putting out a blog post relatively soon. We're hoping to get this, you know, stood up as quickly as possible. So just keep an eye on Twitters. And one other thing, another big part of news this week was ETH2 testnets. So we have Status releasing their Nimbus client this week, and we have Prilabs and Sigma releasing theirs very soon. Now, this is awesome. We've been speaking about how testnets were coming over the last few weeks, and we finally got the first one out in production. I know that a few people in the ETH community have posted on Twitter saying they're running them. Vitalik posted as well. I'm going to get mine set up on the weekend. I think you set it up as well, Eric. But yeah, it's happening. It's finally here. We've got testnet clients. We can start, you know, testing things, doing benchmarks, getting hardware requirements, which has been a huge question. And we're also going to be documenting all of this on Ether. We're going to have a dedicated page to kind of hardware requirements and networking requirements and different benchmarks from different client implementations. So yeah, it's good to see these things finally come to life, because it's been about 9 months since the phase zero spec started, because the original Casper and sharding work were merged, and you know, it's been quite a quick turnaround. So we're on track, I think, for end of year kind of mainnet, as long as there's no critical problems with the testnets. So it's happy April, I guess. Awesome. So onto the news now. Just one bit of news I wanted to talk about this week. Another exchange hack. So BitPum got hacked again. I think this is the third time they've been hacked, which is quite embarrassing for them. I think they're the most popular exchange in South Korea at the moment, at least by trading volume. So basically what happened was there was $13 million worth of EOS stolen. It's suspected that it was an inside job, of course. I think there was some XRP as well from that. But yeah, so I made a joke on Twitter about how, you know, when are the EOS block producers going to reverse this transaction? But apparently the people who stole the EOS were dumping it quite fast on other exchanges. So I'm not sure. I haven't seen a post-mortem about it just yet. But yeah, it's quite embarrassing that this kind of exchange, it isn't a small exchange, has been, you know, hacked yet again, especially via inside job, which, you know, is quite ridiculous considering, you know, these exchanges normally have kind of setups with multi-sigs and things like that. So these inside jobs have a very low chance of happening. But, you know, without the details, we can only speculate. This obviously paints the picture of decentralized exchanges being needed more and more. We'll speak about this a lot, but, you know, they're still not ready yet because of liquidity issues and scaling issues. But we did talk about Starkware last week, StarkDex, how they're making great strides there. So scalability seems like it'll be solved, and liquidity, you know, it depends. I think liquidity is going to be something that we see evolve over time. There's a lot of people trying to focus on it, but I think it's just a bear market symptom. I think in a bull market, we're going to see a lot more liquidity come into the market, especially if these decentralized exchanges are scalable. And then these, you know, the everyday traders will want to use these, and it won't be expensive for them to use either.
Yeah, I mean, I'm scared to even send any crypto to an exchange these days. I don't really do any trading or anything anymore, so I pretty much avoid at all costs. But I mean, even like a Coinbase or Gemini, which I would relatively trust, I would feel like dirty just keeping it there for more than a couple of minutes, just because I feel like at any moment it could be stolen. I mean, yeah, we talk a lot, like you mentioned StarkDex. I think these scaling solutions are coming, and you know, we at some point we're going to go through another bull run, and I think a lot of these exchange hacks in the last like year or two have been, I mean, people have lost money. I guess the one in Canada was pretty large, but you just know like a really big one that's going to affect Bitcoin and Ether or something like that is going to happen. And if you kind of have these scaling solutions lined up for decentralized exchanges at the same time, that's probably going to be the catalyst that happens. You know, I think we'll see a small movement over as these scaling solutions come on. But then if you have another like really big exchange hack, I'm talking like the Bitfinex one back in 2015, where a very large amount of Bitcoin got stolen, or even Gox style, right, where there's a huge portion of Bitcoin stolen. Like, I think it's going to have to be, and you just know it's going to happen, right? Like, obviously a lot of these exchanges are running shops, basically, it sounds like, out of their garage, which with not much OPSEC at all. But I think it's going to be a combination of scaling and then a large hack that's going to, at that point, you could kind of see the floodgates open, I think, for decentralized exchange popularity.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, you know, about how the exchanges hold a lot of crypto. Like, I know for a fact that Coinbase holds 25% of all Litecoin, 8% of all ETH, and 5% of all Bitcoin, which is quite ridiculous when you think about it, right? I mean, I know Coinbase has, I've seen their security setup. I think it's best in class. They definitely need to have a best in class setup because they're offering custody solutions now. So it would be very interesting if they ever got hacked, because they, like, I've seen the lengths that they go to. There was a blog post published a while ago, but I've seen the lengths that they go to using kind of Faraday tents and cages and, you know, just only using a laptop that's never connected to the internet to generate private keys for offline kind of storage and splitting the keys and all this kind of fancy OPSEC stuff. So I'd be very surprised if an exchange like Coinbase, their cold storage was ever hacked, because that would kind of cast doubt over, I think, basically every kind of custody solution. Because if Coinbase can't do it, then how can we trust anyone to do it? Coinbase has arguably been in it for kind of the most amount of time, like, and still around, because obviously we had Gox that's older, but Gox has been gone for a few years now, but Coinbase is still around. To my knowledge, they've never suffered a hack of their cold storage. So yeah, I think it definitely depends on reputation and kind of how long that these exchanges have been around. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I think DEXs still have their place, of course. And Coinbase is its own beast. It's more like a bank than an exchange these days anyway.
Yeah. The other interesting thing too is like all the exchanges are kind of stepping their fees up, right? Like Coinbase had... For a while they had maker fees were zero, and they just added like trading. If you're a maker and you put an order on a book instead of take one, like, they had free fees for that, and now they don't. So that'll be interesting too, because if we're talking like something like StarkDex, when I talk to those guys, like, the fees are very small for that. So beyond just custody, like, if we can start to get speed and lower fees on DEXs too, like, then you're really starting to talk, right? Like, if you can knock all three of those out of the park, then you're really going to start to see the stampede.
Yeah, fees definitely a big thing. Not sure if Coinbase has just raised their fees due to the bear market. I'm sure that they'll have some like kind of promotional things that they do, you know, down the line, especially in a bull market where they lower fees. But yeah, I definitely think that decentralized exchanges can get to that point where they're both performant and cheaper, you know, than they are now. And maybe one day they get to a point where they're cheaper and more performant than centralized exchanges. You know, who knows? There's all types of magic technology coming out, like Starks, that might be able to, you know, achieve that kind of scalability.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So next, project updates. What's new in ETH2 this week? I think we missed this one last week. Ben was kind of busy, but he put out a longer edition this week to make up for it. So it was called the Taking Stock Edition. So he kind of reviewed what's been going on in ETH2 over the last 9 months. As I mentioned before, 9 months ago, the old Casper and Sharding designs were scrapped and then kind of merged into this, what we have today, ETH2 kind of beacon chain spec. The phase zero spec was nothing 9 months ago. Now it's fully fleshed out. You can see all the details in the post. It's quite amazing to see how fast it all moved. You know, Ben goes through phase zero, the beacon chain, how it's basically, the spec's basically complete. And now obviously we have testnets, as I mentioned before. Then he talks about phase one is starting to ramp up now. And then phase two, which is kind of still very much non-existent. The spec document doesn't exist yet. It's just scattered in research posts and things like that. But it's good to see phase one picking up already, considering that we've got the testnet for phase zero out already. So when we have mainnet by end of the year, hopefully, then phase one can launch next year, and then phase two the year after it. And kind of phase two is the main, like, anything after phase two is kind of very, very experimental and you know, not critical to the success, because phase two gives us the state and execution layer, which basically puts it on feature parity with ETH1 today, with all the improvements such as, you know, sharding for scalability and proof of stake and things like that. So yeah, I definitely recommend giving it a read. There's a lot packed in here. He also gives a nice shout out to our podcast with Vitalik, which was nice to see. So thank you, Ben. Yeah, so go have a read of that. But yeah, what did you think of this, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about Ben in this. He does a great job with this. So, and I appreciate the shout out for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how it's almost like, what isn't new to these days? I feel like it's so hard to keep up. Like, everyone's kind of obsessed right now for whatever reason with ProgPow and all this stuff. But like, meanwhile, the E2 teams just have had their heads down, just pumping out the specs and the releases and now the test nets. I mean, one of my favorite things about the E2 teams is like how transparent they are into their processes. Like, you can really, they all put out pretty much, I think, like bi-weekly development updates, and it, like, their GitHubs are really active, and they all have channels you can join on Discord or Telegram. And there's a lot of transparency into it. And I mean, if you're actually trying to follow it, I mean, if you're someone out there that's just constantly poo-pooing E2.0, it's easy to say, no one even knows what's going on with E2. Like, who knows what's even happening here? Some of my favorite hedge fund managers out there like to say that stuff. But if you're actually like engaging and trying to follow this stuff, there's a lot happening. And it's really cool to see the testnets come online. And when Vitalik was on the podcast, he basically said, yeah, they're coming very, very soon. And lo and behold, Status released it a few days ago. And I was running that on my Mac. And it's pretty awesome to see it all starting to come together. So yeah, I mean, like you were saying, it's just crazy how fast it's moved and how much is happening. It's hard to keep up. But I guess in wrapping this up, I want to give a big shout out to all the E2 teams and how, not even how awesome you guys are, but like the transparency into the process and being able to follow along everything. I think they've done a great job with that.
Yeah, definitely second that. I know I've spoken personally to some of the teams, and they're very, very responsive whenever I have questions, especially for ETH Hub. Obviously, we want to get everything onto ETH Hub, which, you know, quick shout out, we've got the revised ETH2 page going up soon. I'm just putting the final touches on it. We had someone complete the bounty for that, which is really cool. So that's going to have a lot of the extra details in there. We've got up to phase two, of course, and then we've got links to check out the other three phases that are currently not specced out, but kind of in research phase. And we'll keep that updated as much as possible. We've also got a new updated ETH1.x page that should be live by the time this podcast goes out. That was completed by the same person that's doing the ETH2 page for us. So yeah, he earned about 250 DAI for his work, which is through Gitcoin, which is really awesome. So yeah, we're going to be putting more bounties out. That were the only two we had live so far, but we're going to be putting a lot more out. We've got a whole spreadsheet of things we want to get on there. So keep an eye on the ETH Hub Twitter for that. And you know, speaking of Gitcoin, you know, it's a perfect segue into my next update. So Gitcoin this week introduced a platform fee. So this is really interesting to see. So they introduced a 10% fee for people who post issues on Gitcoin. Now, I think this was received quite positively from the comments, you know, I've seen on Twitter, because people are always wondering how are these crypto native businesses going to make money. And a lot of them haven't really thought about this. Some of the, obviously the token projects are like, oh, well, our token will appreciate if, you know, our product's successful. And you know, that's not necessarily true. Nick Carter put out a tweet thread about this. It's on, I think it's in the newsletter. I'm pretty sure I linked it in the newsletter. So he put out a tweet thread about value accrual and ICOs and tokens and all that. And he used MasterCoin as the perfect example of how MasterCoin, which is now Omni, houses or is home to Tether. And Tether has like a $2-3 billion market cap, and MasterCoin is nowhere near that. I think it's like less than 100 million or something, or Omni or whatever it was called. So obviously the base layer chain, the coin of the base layer, hasn't accrued much value. So what's to say your token won't accrue much value even if your project is wildly successful? We've spoken about token economics before on the podcast, especially around governance tokens like 0x and Maker. You know, Maker's done quite well, and so 0x if you compare it to ICO price. But if you're talking about the long-term kind of value accrual, you're going to need more than relying on just your token price to run a viable business, I think. And it's great to see Gitcoin doing this, even though Gitcoin doesn't have a token. Obviously, they can't rely on that since they, you know, obviously don't have one. But you know, they did the platform fee for ongoing sustainability, and Gitcoin obviously provides a great service to the community. The Gitcoin Grants program is awesome. Shout out to everyone that's donated to us. We actually got a big donation this week from someone for 1500 DAI. So thank you very much to that person for donating to us. But yeah, on Grants you can donate to so many different people on there. And, you know, without Gitcoin spearheading this, we wouldn't have that. So I'm pleased to see that they're thinking about their sustainability going forward and not just relying on the goodwill of the community, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first of all, Gitcoin, like you said, one of my favorite projects out there. And it's funny, when Kevin was on the podcast, he was saying like how tempting it really was to consider an ICO at the time, when, because of obviously Gitcoin was kind of launching during all the ICO madness, and he turned it down. He did like not really close the door on a potential future token for Gitcoin. So it seems like they're starting to explore some profitability models. I'm all for these apps trying things like this, right? I mean, I use the example of EtherDelta. So I guess stepping back a little bit, the counter I always see to this is, oh, it's an open source product. If you put a fee in there, people are just going to fork it and take the fee out. That was a fear like I even had early on. We had with EtherX when we were trying it, because we were trying to come up with business models and everyone was like, oh, if you put anything in, they're going to fork it out. I do think people will eventually fork out tokens that are truly useless. I'm not convinced putting a small fee into your business is going to be forked out, because network effect is very important, right? At this point, Gitcoin has the network effect when it comes to their business. And we want these businesses to be sustainable, especially if they didn't go through an ICO, right? Like, we want them to try other things. Like, we can't trash ICOs and then trash them for trying to make money in other ways. So I think putting a little fee in here, and I'll go back to EtherDelta, like they lived with a 0.3% trading fee for like a year and a half. And that was a very, very easily open source forkable product, and no one did it. And they made over $1 million in fees. I dug into the contract account once, and they were making a lot of money off of fees. So, you know, people aren't going to go in there and just fork this out. So I'm totally open to products that need to some kind of monetization to happen to expand to try this. So 10% sounds like a lot, but really it's probably not in the long run. And the other things we're kind of seeing are starting to charge for like pro features, like maybe Uniswap could offer like for a pro side of their trading book, like digging into stats and all that stuff. So I think we're going to start to see these experiments happen, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you talk about forking out tokens, things like that. Obviously, we saw Uniswap. It didn't fork out the Bancor token. It just recreated kind of the Bancor model and started from a fresh new project. So it's not kind of a one-to-one comparison, but it does work sometimes, right? But most of the time, you can fork the code, you can fork everything, but you can't really fork the state. And by that, you can't fork the community, you can't fork the funds that are already locked. So if you were to kind of fork MakerDAO today, you'd fork the contracts and everything, but you're not forking the over 2 million ETH that's locked up in the MakerDAO contracts. You know what I'm saying? So it's important to remember that, because someone can obviously fork Gitcoin or whatever right now and stand up their own without the fee. But I mean, is anyone going to use it? Probably not, because it's a copycat platform. It's probably got people that don't understand it very well compared to the Gitcoin team who created it, and all these sorts of things. So I think that forking out a token works sometimes, doesn't work all the time, unless the token is kind of really cumbersome for the platform. So if you actually need the token to interact with the platform, I can imagine if you actually needed 0x to use a relayer, that would be forked out straight away. You know what I mean? Like, no one would use that, and 0x would be, you know, wouldn't be as popular as it is today. Same with Maker. You do need tokens when paying down fees, like you need some Maker tokens. But other than that, you don't need it to do anything else, really, except if you want to participate in voting. But that's separate to taking out a CDP and drawing some DAI. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what other kind of business models people come up with for their different apps, because monetization in open source software can be hard because, as you said, forkability and things like that. But I don't think, you know, it has to be hard. I think if done right, these companies can make a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're going to see, you know, especially as they start to gain network effect and try this out, I think there's money to definitely be made. We just haven't seen these models explored yet.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of Maker, they put out an update this week about multicollateral DAI. So this is quite a big update, actually. They kind of gave a high-level overview of multicollateral DAI, and they gave us a sneak peek of the multicollateral DAI CDP portal, which is really cool to see. It's just a GIF going through it. I posted it on Twitter. It's in the blog post, which you can find in the newsletter anyway. And you can also play with the contracts on Kovan, the Kovan testnet now, which is really cool. No kind of release dates around multilateral DAI yet in this blog post, but it's good to see that they're getting closer. You know, DAI and Maker are always in the news. We speak about it probably every week on this podcast. We spoke about last week how Justin Drake put out a tweet thread taking like the contrary or devil's advocate approach to Maker, saying that he thinks multilateral DAI is too complex and single collateral DAI could work if you could even just fork out the Maker token and make it work like that. You know, maybe that happens. Maybe we live in a world where multilateral DAI gets deployed and then people maybe don't, you know, want to be part of that, and someone forks the single collateral DAI contracts and people start using that just like, Uniswap, basically, without a token or anything, and it becomes its own thing. I actually fully expect something like that to happen, to be honest, because it's just too obvious for it not to. Because single collateral DAI has worked very, very well up until now. Obviously, the peg's been kind of a bit loose there, but there are other levers that can be pulled, to kind of save the peg. We'll see what happens. The DAI might be different as well, because in single collateral, it won't be Maker's DAI. It'll be like a different DAI. It gets a bit messy when you think about it, but you know, I'm very curious to see what happens there.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how multi-collateral DAI plays out. I mean, we had Rune, the CEO and founder of Maker, on the podcast last week, and we talked a lot about this. I mean, I definitely have some concerns around the risk governance of this, but, you know, I think to push open finance to the next level, I'm hoping that things like multi-collateral DAI can work, right? Because we really need to open up other collateral types and options and kind of more riskier loans. Obviously, we'll really get there with like identity and reputation, but this will at least allow kind of like a different set or array of interest rates and collateral types, which will be cool to see. I do think potentially people will get burned on some bad risk governance and less liquid tokens, but that's fine. I mean, there's definitely kind of if you're going into this, you probably know what you're getting into. The most exciting part about multi-collateral DAI, though, is to me, at least, the DAI savings rate, which kind of finally balances that supply and demand side of DAI stability. Right now, we kind of just have the stability fee to play with, and we've seen that's kind of been a roller coaster of emotions in the last few weeks. Like, we raised it to, or they raised it to 3.5 and then 7.5, and it's still kind of floating underneath 1. So I think we really need to get this multi-collateral DAI system online to really kind of not only see like the full of what Maker can do, but also to make sure that DAI peg stays closer to 1.
Yeah, it's all an experiment at the end of the day. So we'll see how this plays out. Hopefully, DAI returns to $1 before multicollateral DAI comes out. I think it will, because I don't expect multicollateral for it to come out for a few months still. And I think that another stability fee rise will be on the table very soon, considering that DAI is hovering around 96, 97 cents still, which might annoy even more people, but we'll see what happens. Cool. So the next thing I want to talk about was the US stock index token was released by UMA protocol this week. So this was announced a few weeks ago. UMA was announced a few weeks ago, and they released their first product. So it's an ERC-20 token, and it represents a synthetic ownership of an index of the 500 largest exchange listed US stocks. Now, that's a mouthful, but basically it means that anyone can now participate in the US stock market. So anyone with an internet connection and an Ethereum wallet, which is, you know, most of the world has access to that at this point. And you can basically trade these synthetic assets, which is really cool to see. It's instantly interoperable with basically everything on Ethereum, considering it's adhering to the ERC-20 token standard. And yeah, it's just basically what we've been talking about with this whole kind of DeFi and open finance movement and a lot of this interoperability going on between these different assets. You know, I think a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months now, we spoke about that exchange that went live that was allowing you to trade kind of representations of different stocks. That's very different to this. This is, I think this is more than a representation. I'm not an expert on synthetic assets, but, you know, it's a different implementation of it. You'll be able, it's an ERC-20 token, so you'll be able to move it around wherever you please. So yeah, what did you think of this one, Eric?
Yeah, I'm super pumped for this. I mean, we've talked a lot about kind of trading stocks via ERC-20s in the past. I mean, if I'm being completely blunt, I'm kind of tired of the whole lending and borrowing side of DeFi. Like, that's just one aspect, right, of finance and where we can go here. super pumped for eventually being able to trade stocks as ERC-20s. I think that's going to become a reality one day. Like, the benefits are just there. Like, we've talked about 24/7 trading and like instant global reach and just kind of true ownership and security around your stock and custody of it. I think we're going to get there. So these kind of smaller stepping stones with like this UMA token, which, like you mentioned, kind of represents this index of the S&P 500, you know, this is a good start. Like, I'm sure this isn't, I don't know, like how on the legal and regulation side, if we're quite there yet, but you know that companies like an E-Trade or Fidelity or some of these stock custody solutions, or even maybe down, I know NASDAQ's been interested in Ethereum in the past. So it just seems completely inevitable to me that stocks are eventually going to be traded using something like an ERC-20. So I'm pumped to see kind of these strides be taken. I'm really excited. And beyond stocks, right, we've talked about tokenizing real estate and things like that. Like, I really want to see these real world assets come on the chain. And so it's, anytime we see news like this, I think it's great.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely think it's when, not if, with regards to trading stocks as ERC-20 tokens. It's just, there's so many obvious benefits that it's a matter of time, basically. Cool. So onto the on-chain activity for the week. It was really cool to see you put out a tweet this week, Eric, about the Ethereum active addresses were starting to rise again, and they kind of decoupled from price. Now, you put this tweet out a few days ago, and of course, today we saw, we're recording this on a Monday, Monday night. We saw the price of Bitcoin spike pretty heavily, I think to like almost 5,000, and ETH spiked as well because of that. But it was kind of cool to see that the price had decoupled from active addresses, which means there's more network activity happening. And now the price has kind of followed, which is, I don't know whether that was, you know, correlates one-to-one, but it was just a really curious timing. So, but yeah, it was your tweet. So you walk us through basically your thinking around that.
Yeah, I guess a little background. I'm a big fan of thinking that network activity leads to price. And it, so I guess for a short shout out to Coinmetrics, because they kind of enable like really quickly being able to generate graphs that kind of represent network utility and usage and price. So I was looking at, and actually I look at this graph a lot, and I just haven't really shared it too much in the past publicly, but active addresses, I like looking at transactions mainly for Bitcoin. Transactions on Ethereum is a little misleading, because actually like gas used is more important. So like the historical transaction chart for Ethereum is a bit misleading in the last, I would say, year, because it looks like it's going down, but actually network utilization is flat around like 90%. That's just because transactions have become a little bit more costly on the gas side because people are using dApps over simple sends. But anyways, not to get too far off track here, I prefer to use active addresses. So if you think of like the active addresses on Ethereum would be a good indicator of how much it's being used and growing. If you look at it historically, and this is the graph I put out on Twitter, at times price lags behind active addresses, but it actually tracks it really well historically. And anytime that it lagged, price lagged behind, so there's a large gap in active addresses in price, it eventually caught up. So it did this, I believe, like in early 2016, and then around early 2017, there was a gap, and eventually price caught up, and a couple times price overshot usage. But in general, it tracks it really well until the last year, where there's a pretty wide gap. And active addresses had been kind of on the downfall a little bit the last, I guess, 6 or 8 months off of the peaks. And a lot of that probably had to do with the Ice Age. Like, it wasn't as easy to get transactions through, but we've seen an uptick from the bottom in the last month or so, and that gap starting to widen. I personally fully expect that to close. I mean, I'm not using this to call a price rise or saying that Ether is going to rise, but I mean, just looking at this historically, and I'm a big believer in activity driving price. I mean, if you look at, if the gap were to close, I think the graph basically shows that Ether should be valued around 400 or 500 or so. If someone asked me what I thought the true value of Ether should be right now, I'd probably say in the 300 to 400 levels. So yeah, it's just interesting to kind of look at these different graphs and kind of measure network activity versus price. And this is one of my favorite to look at. And I definitely expect this gap to close at some point.
Yeah, it's one of my kind of favorite things to look at as well, just network activity as a whole on Ethereum, especially. As you mentioned, kind of gas usage has remained kind of steady throughout the entire bear market, and actually grew a lot because people were doing more complex transactions, you know, especially in the DeFi space. And then active addresses as well spiking up. There's a lot of different metrics. And as you said, Coinmetrics is a great website to go to see all these various metrics and be able to compare with different networks. You know, there's metrics on inflation, you know, total addresses, kind of all that sort of stuff. And a quick shout out to On-Chain FX as well as part of Messari. It's their kind of crypto market dashboard. They've got a bunch of different stats on there as well. So definitely go check those out. And if you're wondering about how Eric and I kind of, you know, view these sorts of things and view the network and view price and things like that, we don't really talk about price too much, but we think about it a lot, like a lot, because it's obviously a great indicator of a bunch of different things, market sentiment and things like that. And then network activities lets us see that Ethereum is actually growing. It's not just our little echo chamber that shows that Ethereum's growing. So yeah, definitely recommend going to check out those two sites, On-Chain FX and Coinmetrics, and playing around with it a bit and let us know what you think. You know, we're happy to help, happy to answer questions. Some of the metrics can get a bit complicated. But yeah, just reach out on Twitter if you need any help with that one. So last thing I wanted to talk about was a awesome tweet thread that Andrew Cyber_Hokey put out this week. We've spoken about him in the past. I think he did another tweet thread a while ago. But this one was about explaining the Ethereum improvement proposal, kind of the EIP process. He has been very active in the ProgPow debate on Twitter. You might have seen him going back and forth with a lot of the kind of, I guess you'd say, thought leaders in this space, like Vlad Zamfir and people like that. Going, you know, back and forth about ProgPow, about governance decisions, about how they're made, about how to gauge sentiment, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, in this tweet thread, he went through that he kind of fully understands that EIPs are a technical process. They're not meant to kind of take into the social aspect of it or community sentiment around them. They're literally there as a technical kind of upgrade to the protocol that are reviewed based on technical merit and nothing got to do with, you know, if it should be implemented or not. So obviously ProgPow has been reviewed on technical merit and it's sound according to a lot of the core developers, but the community at large is more concerned about kind of risks and security holes. And that's why there's a whole audit going on at the moment and trying to get money to get the code audited so that there's no backdoors or anything like that. You know, and then that kind of spins off into all the contention around how these things get implemented, because to the core devs, this is technically sound. It makes sense to be included because ProgPow takes theoretically, or it should, to kind of take ASICs off the network, and Ethereum's always been anti-ASIC. Definitely recommend going and give that tweet thread a read. It is quite long, but it is very good explanation. And then also to complement that, there's a blog post that I've put in the newsletter as well by Boris Mann. He explains Ethereum's governance and kind of holistically, not just the EIP process, but basically everything. And I've also reached out to him he's going to hopefully write us up an ETHUB page about it as well, a bit of more of a condensed version because his blog post is quite long. But definitely if you're interested in all the Ethereum governance kind of talk and chatter that you've been seeing lately on Twitter, because Twitter's been going off about it for the last few weeks, definitely go check out those two, you know, and you get a better idea of where people's heads are in this space. So yeah, I know, Eric, you've been a bit vocal about ProgPow, the kind of contention around it and all this kind of stuff about governance being more heated because it's a bear market. Basically, people are bored. They're kind of finding things to fight about. So what did you think of kind of Andrew's tweet and even the blog post that Boris put out?
Yeah, well, Ether is 150 now. Bitcoin's 5,000. So I don't know. What is ProgPow again? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, it seems like we've all forgotten about it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like, what you focus on during it. Like, we're in the depths of a bear market. Like, in ProgPow, yes, it's important. Like, we're learning a lot of governance lessons here, which to me is why it's important. But in the grand scheme of things, is it the end-all, be-all? No, it's just what everyone's decided to focus on. But I guess going back to so Andrew's awesome, highly recommend a follow. You said it, but Cyber_Hokey on Twitter. I'm assuming that's, I think that's because he went to Virginia Tech, the Hokies, I'm guessing. But anyways, so he did a really good recap of the EIP process. And yeah, it's like, it's not supposed to kind of judge like what we're seeing as far as the Prog Pow drama goes, right? And that's kind of why like we had the idea to do the this different forum, which we don't have a name yet. If you go on the forum right now, it's just called Ethereum Users, which is super lame. Although I put out a post like asking for name suggestions and they all sucked. So I don't know. There were some funny ones, but I don't think there are actually ones we can use. But we just need more signals out there. I mean, I think everyone's kind of freaking out that the Ethereum governance process is broken. And I completely disagree. I think to this point, it's actually been great. Like nothing has failed, in my opinion, to this point. It's just that we need some better options to look at whenever the core devs don't want to make these decisions. And I know Andrew went back and forth a lot with Nick Johnson, who we've also had in the podcast, and he's one of my favorite people in the space, kind of explaining the EIP process and exactly what it is and what it should be used for. And I think, you know, we're just learning lessons here, and there needs to be other stakeholders represented, and the core devs, as I mentioned earlier, they shouldn't be, and I don't think they want to be the end all be all in all of this decision making process. They should just be judging these things on technical merit, and then the rest of the community could kind of have their say on like if we should be doing it and why they have concerns or why they like it or whatnot. So I think this. Again, to be honest, like if ProgPow goes in, great. Like I trust the core devs, and I do for sure want to see an audit. But I'm not going to lose any sleep if ProgPow goes in, right? I think if anything, we've learned a lot of good lessons from this. And anybody out there from another chain that claims they have governance fixed, I mean, we're recording this on April Fool's Day, so that's probably the best April Fool's joke of all. Like no one has figured this out yet, right? And it's going to take years to kind of staple down this process over. Overall.
Yeah, I reckon we could do like a few hour kind of podcast on governance and all the different approaches to it, especially with these on-chain governance systems coming online as well. But we're out of time for today. So yeah, thank you everyone for tuning in again to our podcast. If you haven't subscribed yet, you can go to ethub.substack.com to check out the newsletter and everything we've talked about. And of course, subscribe if you haven't. And if you need to subscribe to the podcast, you can go to podcast.ethub.io. So yeah, we'll catch you next week, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.